I started writing this book, I did not know that I was going that it was going to be a book. So I'm very pleased that it even got published, but I'm doubly pleased at the response that I have received across the boards. It's been really satisfying.
Well, I want to wish you again the best of luck. The website is octaviosolis.net, and you can get the book at citylights.com. Thank you so much, Octavio.
Thank you, Sonali. My pleasure.
Octavio Solis has written over 20 plays. He's considered to be one of the most prominent Latino playwrights in America. And we've been discussing his new book, Retablo, Stories from a Life Lived Along the Border. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.
Hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived, and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
You're listening to KBO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Andre Gladden's six-month Angelversary on Saturday, July 6th from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the intersection of Southeast 96th and Market Street in Portland. On January 6th, Andre Gladden, a 36-year-old black man who suffered from paranoid schizophrenia, was shot and killed by a Portland police officer who failed to use de-escalation techniques. Family from California will be coming up for the six-month anniversary memorial event. Again, that's the six-month anniversary of Andre Gladden on Saturday, July 6th from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the intersection of Southeast 96th and Market Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland. Coming up at 9 o'clock is Radio Zine, where we're featuring an episode of KBOO's own Labor Radio. Our episode from Monday. Following up after that is an episode from Pacifica's Sprouts.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Holla! Welcome to the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists segment of Labor Radio, highlighting the works of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class, here where the heart of the community comes alive 7 days a week. Before we get started with our show, I'd like to let our listeners know that we've had a program change. Originally, we were going to talk tonight about the interactive things that were happening with the redefining Alberta Street. That show has been postponed. Tonight, we have another show. Tonight, we have a show regarding the AFL-CIO and the University of Oregon Labor Education Research Center, Summer School. It's happening this year, 2019. But I forgot to tell you, my name is Tina Turner Morfitt. I am a member of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Retirees Union. And I'm the current president of the Coalition of Black Trades Union.
Good afternoon, Portland. This is Deborah Hall with the American Federation of Teachers here in Oregon. I'm the current secretary treasurer for the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists here in Oregon. Thanks for joining our show.
And I'm Dr. Audrey Terrell, the Vice President of the Oregon Coalition of Black Trade Unions and retired from the International Staff of the UAW and the President of Dr. Audrey Terrell Institute.
So tonight, our segment, as I said, we're going to focus on the Oregon AFL-CIO and the University of Oregon Labor Education Research Center 2019 Summer School. Our guest tonight is Sherman Henry. He is a faculty coordinator at the University of Oregon. Welcome, brother.
Thank you, Tina.
So, talk to us about this summer school this year. What's up?
Well, this year our theme is Awakening and Unifying an Intergenerational Labor Movement. It's from August 2nd through the 4th, 2019, at the Oregon University of Oregon Eugene campus.
So when I looked at the application and the flyer, it looks like this curriculum is a little bit different than what I've seen in the past. What's up with that?
Sure. We're trying to kind of bridge the gap between new workers and veteran workers in the workforce. And we're trying to create a curriculum that unifies and awakens folks, particularly as we think about the whole Red for Ed movement. We think about now what's going on in the private sector with building trades. So we're now trying to just bridge that gap and have a real conversation about post-millennials, millennials, baby boomers, and everybody in between.
I see. So it seems like you're trying to bring more people to the table and also trying to expand on the people who normally go to these labor education summer schools. Is that about right?
That's about right.
Okay. Well, go ahead.
Partly because, as you know, we're having all kind of challenges in the state right now as it relates to labor rights. So we think it's worthy of a conversation between our generation and those who labor in the workforce to kind of make sure that they now have a comprehensive way to kind of look at what was done 50 years ago and what's now a 2019 issue.
Okay, so talk to me about this focus on millennial workers.
Well, again, we want to talk about internal organizing. We want to talk about building power. And there's always a conversation among veterans about whether or not they understand the millennials and what the millennials want.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're saying let's all come together and have a conversation about what we all need and unify as it relates to benefit, wages, and how we communicate. And clearly we understand that not everybody is coming to one job anymore, working 30, 40 years. So all of these different paradigms is what we have to talk about to build a stronger and viable labor movement here in Oregon.
Sherman, thanks for being here with us on the show. And a question I have and an interest, it seems to me that what I do love about the millennial generation is they seem more wanting to be together, more togetherness, and in smaller groups of people. And I'm excited because I think we're going to get some good organizing ideas and, you know, more people to talk to in a more kind of an open situation, whereas not so paired off as this group of workers versus this group of workers, but just people talking to people.
Sure. That's the idea, that we're all workers from different aspects of life, and we all want to have a quality of life, earn decent wages. So, yeah, we definitely want to have a conversation about how it has changed over the years and what we need to do now to accommodate a greater pool of activists.
Okay, Sherm. You've been talking about the older workers, who I am, after 40, 40 or 50 years in the union movement. But I'm so glad this is an opportunity that we can hear from the younger generation, and I just hope during this program that there is a time for open discussion about the past, the current and the present, and the future.
Sure.
And I'm sure during that time, those 2 or 3 days, that we can have that, because, you know, I know a lot of times youth can come in and just push us to the side, but they need to learn from what we did wrong in the past. It didn't work, because a lot of this is flowing over to them what we said and did not do. So that's one subject area that I was hoping that we pretty much cover in the summer school this year.
Well, one of the things that we don't want folks to believe that this is about throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about, I'm so happy about that.
So we're talking about courses like building inclusive unions through mentoring and allyship.
Oh, good.
We're talking about facing sexual harassment and microaggressions in the workplace. What are some of the tools and tactics workers can use to kind of mitigate those circumstances. Mm-hmm. We're talking about building bridges, not walls, unions and immigration. We're talking about more bread and butter bargaining for the common good with an expanded view on equity and inclusion and how we're dealing with this intergenerational movement. Mm-hmm. And particularly, as some of you all know, we just got through with a LGBTQ summit.
Right.
And we had over 80 activists there. So the workforce is changing. How people identify is changing. So we want to kind of build a movement that is really in the spirit of solidarity.
Mm-hmm. There's one other area that of major concern to me is women in leadership. How that is supported, encouraged, trained, whatever, you know, our summer school can offer to encourage women in leadership. I wrote my dissertation on that, and that was then. But I'm talking about now. Women make a difference. And so, you know, I'm just looking forward to an opportunity to hear discussions on training women for leadership.
Well, again, definitely so. And as the population change, particularly in the building trades, right? We know that there's a significant amount of jobs and we don't have qualified trades persons to fill those jobs. So we want to also have a conversation about that pipeline. How do we go from high school to career? For those who are not going to go to college. Mm-hmm. And so women definitely is part of the intersection of our discussions and one of the focal points on building an inclusive and intergenerational movement, because as we all know, that the workforce population is changing.
Yes, that's so true.
Yeah, it sounds really encouraging, because union jobs are honest jobs.
Yes.
But I think where we fall down sometimes is, you know, we have a mold already, and we keep relying on that same mold on how to bring people in. But as folks change, we need to change. And so that's what this sounds like. Sounds like these classes are designed to do that.
Yeah, it's to take a hard look at what we do good and what we can improve on.
Sure.
And who we are now going to be representing, and what is the permanent interest, right? There's this whole saying that there's no permanent friends,
sure,
no permanent enemies, but permanent interests. So as we think about what's going to happen in the future workforce, we definitely want to give people the tools to kind of function on information, critical thinking that they may not have had in their previous workforce, right? So we know union density is not as high in certain markets as it should be.
Sure.
So folks just need the opportunity to be trained and given the tools that they can now think about these global issues critically from a local base.
Okay, so you talked about building trades. Now, I know that's not your forte in particular, but I believe this is the first that I've seen of a looking at building trades in depth as far as the summer school is concerned. Can you expound on that a little bit?
Well, again, so the answer is yes, and we just want to have a real conversation about building trades,
mm-hmm,
trades jobs, those students who are not going to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
How do we create a pipeline for them and not just have unorganized jobs, but mm-hmm, we want union jobs that pays better wages, benefits, etc. But we also want to talk about equity and inclusion as well. And
okay,
so having a significant conversation with them about these various apprenticeship programs. How do you get into apprenticeship programs?
Mm-hmm.
What skills are needed to kind of become a good tradesperson? And how we kind of look at those generations or those populations who are not necessarily doing as well in the workforce, giving them the tools that they can compete for these jobs as well.
Brother Sherman, is on your agenda for the summer school, is there a youth gap fair opportunity? You know, sometimes we got to get into people's heads early, you know. 16, 17, 18, that, hey, you know, we push college on them, but most of our youth is not college material. But if you get in their mind, this is what's required. You need math. So is there a youth portion somewhere on there? Youth meaning, I don't know what your age group of attendance, because it is during summer school and a lot of youth is out of school. But I just was thinking, was there some particular time assigned to youth to listen and to encourage and share with them how good these union jobs are, and without a college debt,
right,
you know, you can really advance. I just a question I'd ask. I'm curious about that.
So the summer school is designed primarily for working adults, union members mm-hmm. and those community groups that we may do work with in the community. And so this is not for youth. Okay. However, there are other programs that groups like IBEW 48, mm-hmm. they work a lot with the groups. Donna Hammond spearheads kind of like those programs. But this particular program is specifically for those who are in the workforce currently and seeking leadership or want to become good worksite organizers, want to become good shop stewards.
Okay. Thank you, Sherman. And so what I see this as an ability, well, as for someone who's been, I'm a union job for almost 30 years, it's going to hopefully give me some tools to go back and to be able to talk with the young people who I work with who perhaps aren't engaged in the union, and to be able to talk with them on a not from here's what happened in 1950 and it was the best thing ever, you know what I mean? Yeah. But to talk about things currently now. No. But yes, they're not, you know, yeah. So we don't want, you know, like we get tired of hearing stuff that grandmama did and all that stuff for relevancy now. And so, because we're going to be passing the torch, and I think it'd be very engaging to get them involved because they're the future. And so what do they want? What do they need out of this as well? And I see this as an opportunity to kind of bridge some of those conversations and give us some tools to be able to speak with younger folks about the union movement.
Sure. It's a way that we have to kind of sustain what has been great and now look at what has shifted and how do we now bring more folks into the fold. Like, you know, we just experienced the whole Red for Ed and that was a statewide movement. And so you had all kind of generations there. And so there was a lot of questions from those rallies or group meetings that now we seek to solidify in the classroom setting to give folks tools to critically think about, one, like public education and its effect on, as Dr. Terrell said, how folks function post-high school, right? And making sure that they have the kind of tools and the skills necessary to function in the real world.
So listen up. If I'd like to remind our listeners that you're listening to the Coalition of Black Trades Unionists segment of Labor Radio, highlighting the works of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class, where the heart of the community comes alive 7 days a week. Our guest tonight is Sherman Henry, who is a faculty coordinator at the University of Oregon. Our topic is the Oregon AFL-CIO and Labor Education Research Center 2019 Summer School Program. And so, again, the program seems to be a little different this time. We talked about it being intergenerational. It looks pretty enticing.
Thank you. Yeah, we put some thought into kind of creating a different space to kind of represent our democracy and to make it a more inclusive and welcoming space. And in the years past, we've done that as well, but now we're just trying to go into a specific aspect of what we kind of find through our other training programs, a new platform.
Okay. Well, we talked earlier about how the dynamics of the workforce has changed, and I'm going to use that naughty word, Janice, mm-hmm. Because that has also pointed out to us that we need to change.
Sure.
And so it sounds like your programming and the classes and workshops that you have may help us, give us the ability to do that.
Sure. It's interesting because I just had a conversation with delegates at the OSEA union, and we talked about post-Janice. Mm-hmm. And what is so amazing about the new energies that people find, and they are becoming more creative in their approach to engaging co-workers, right? And so Janice did not create the exodus that they had planned, but it started to create an environment where folks are more engaging and thinking critically about their own future, right? Why would some companies or some multi-billionaires want to just destroy unions? Mm-hmm. And so we don't want people to think about these challenges in the abstract.
Gotcha.
We want to talk about what is the purpose of a union, what we do, and how we affect the community. And we've put out a report recently this year that talk about the $1 billion that we put into the Oregon economy based on union wages, right? Mm-hmm. So that allow us to kind of look at public works. It allow us to look at school funding differently. Sure. It allow us to look at buying houses and having a more efficient way, right, sure, for government to function, but more importantly, how people purchase more goods and services,
okay,
that stimulates the economy. So we don't want people to think about us in the abstract or some union in the distance. We want to talk about unionism as it relates to building communities where the folks who work day in and day out contribute to what is the beautification of this wonderful state.
Okay, all righty. I think you said earlier, you mentioned the phrase equity and inclusion.
Sure.
And it's my impression that that goes beyond the intergenerational piece of it. So how do you go about convincing our brothers and sisters in the union world to start sending more people who can help fulfill that gap?
Well, we know that research shows that when we have conversations about equity and inclusion, it encompasses everything that has been discussed there today. How we look at women's rights, how we mm-hmm. look at pay equity, mm-hmm. right? The difference between women and men pay sometimes. Mm-hmm. How we look at diversity and how folks who identify differently are treated in the workplace. So right. it gets a little deeper,
okay,
in, as it relates to organized labor's role in shaping a kind of inclusive community and society.
Okay, so where you say deeper, I'm going to translate into tangible.
Okay.
Because I've been in the union workforce about 38 years.
Okay.
And I knew that the issues that I was concerned about, they got addressed because I was in the room.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But oftentimes what happens is so many people are not in the room.
That's the difference.
And so I love the fact that you're talking about not just layer one and layer two, that you're talking about a deeper dive, mm-hmm. because folks are not going to show interest if there's no tangibility. So
sure.
mm-hmm. word sure. up on the sure. on the new curriculum.
Yeah. And at some point we'll develop another framework that is about the sense of belonging, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the other part of equity and inclusion. Folks need to feel inclusive, and they need to feel that the shared space that they are comfortable in it
right.
with being their authentic self. So, you know, this is just not research-driven. We want to have a conversation with folks who actually have these lived experiences and draw from those lessons on how do we shape public policy,
uh-huh.
how do we shape personnel policy, how do we get folks from human resources in the room and have a real conversation about what is becoming a very diverse Oregon,
sure.
and how we function in the workforce as one community, one goal.
Okay.
Brother Sherman, I know we have a union listening audience. So on our summer program that you have coming, is there some AFL leaders that will be there to speak with us? Or who do you have on your agenda for that?
Well, the opening night, there will be a town hall meeting with Tom Chamberlain, who is the Oregon AFL-CIO president. And so Tom would have a Q&A session during the town hall meeting. And we'll have several other union leaders throughout the state, both from the private sector, the public sector.
Excellent. Good.
You know, and I hope that in addition to addressing the participants, I'm hoping that they're going to stick around and be a part of these programs and workshops that we're talking about. Because, again, change comes from the top, as in addition to coming from the bottom. And so, again, I'm very excited about this curriculum that we've been talking about.
Sure. And we'll have time for fun, right? We'll have casino night where folks will get a chance to kind of enjoy themselves. We'll have all kind of social events.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have a picnic where a lot of the elected officials will probably come by.
Okay.
And I know there's a lot to talk about now.
Oh, yeah.
Recent development in the state. And so it's not just going to be books and pencils and critical thinking, but some socialization as well.
Here's a very important question. In years past, y'all had karaoke. Are we singing?
Probably not, but if you show up and you want to do a little Aretha Franklin or something, we'll give you a mic.
Well, I know. Now you need, I haven't heard this, but how do you sign up for this summer session?
Just go to our website, the University of Oregon Labor Education and Research Center, and sign up.
It's my impression that it fills up fast, so
yes.
Don't be sitting on your thumbs waiting, you know, because before you know it, classes are going to be filled.
Hopefully so.
Are retirees welcome?
Yeah, if you pay the registration
fee. Okay.
Yeah. Got to pay to play.
But give me that website again, one more time.
University of Oregon Labor Education and Research Center, LERC. And it'll take you to the front page and just follow the directions from there.
Well, all right. I like the idea of the creating a pipeline from high school to work. As we said earlier, not every young person is ready for college at this point. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's a lack of interest, sometimes it's a lack of money. And so I like the idea of us trying to, pardon me, I just inserted myself, I'm sorry. I like the idea of the summer school, including these youth, mm-hmm. so that they understand and that they know that there's real money in working with your hands. It is not anything anyone should be ashamed of. And so, again, I applaud you guys for looking at that aspect, because, again, they just don't know.
Yeah, and so one of the things that we have to kind of think about as relates to the workforce is what Dr. King said many years ago, is that all labor has dignity. So whether or not you're a school bus driver, cafeteria worker, construction worker, professor, or a teacher, we want to make sure that through organized labor that workers have a shot at dignity, decent wages, equitable pay.
Right. You know, these days it's kind of hard to find dignity in the work you do unless you are really hardcore at it. Sure. It's sad, but the employer doesn't see... They don't see the employees as being the most valuable assets anymore.
Sure, sure. So these conversations will help us figure out how to shape that message for generations that's coming behind us and those of us who believe that we have something to say worthy of them listening.
Okay. Well, brother, I'd like to thank you for being a part of our show. And I forgot to tell the audience, he's also a CBDU member, and so can you be also.
Yes.
Anyway. But thank you very much for coming and giving us an enlightened view of what the curriculum is going to be like. Like I said, it sounds pretty hot. And I'm hoping that even those union members that have gone before to sign up again, because this curriculum is much, much different than what you've seen in the past. Yes. Sister Audrey.
Yes, I'd just like to say that CBTU was actively involved in Juneteenth and the CBTU parade and festivities. We had a great time. Madam President was just made it all a good time. So I hope we get to be a part of it next year. But we really had a good time at Juneteenth and Good in the Hood festivities. I'd like to announce that the Coalition of Black Trade Unions meets the second Tuesday of every month at 6 p.m. at the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employee William Lucy Building, located at 6025 East Burnside here in Portland. Join us on July the 9th. And also our email address, we can be contacted at orcbtu10@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you, so join us in an evolving adventure of representing Black union workers.
Well, it's that witching hour. It's time for us to wrap up. And again, I'd like to thank you, Brother Sherman, for being a part of our show tonight and letting us know what's happening at the 2019 summer school.
Sure. Thank you for inviting me in.
We hope to be there.
Thank you, Sherman, for being there. And for those of you don't know who LERC is, go online and look up the Labor Education and Research through U of O, because I'm going to tell you, for in the years that I've been involved in the union and here I'm in Oregon, they provide such good information, helping unions with a myriad of problems with research. If you need some help, check them out and reach out to them.
Holla. Until next month.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
The preceding program was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. More audio can be found online at kboo.fm. You're tuned into KBOO Community Radio. That was KBOO's very own Labor Radio, which you can usually hear on Monday nights at 6. Coming up next in the 9:30 hour here is Sprouts from Pacifica. Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience, produced at a different location every week. Today's program, brought to you by Barry Vogel from the radio show Radio Curious, based out of Ukiah, California. In a 2002 show, Barry explored the history of feminism and why it did not evolve more as civilizations developed.
Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The place of women in the world and in the American society has changed in many aspects in the recent past. Many people say this is due to the politics of feminism, and some inquire, where will it lead? Our guest in this archive edition of Radio Curious is Estelle B. Friedman. In 2002, she was a professor of history at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California, and has a specialty in feminism. She's the author of No Turning Back, The History of Feminism and the Future of Women. She addresses many of the issues in her book in our conversation in this program. I spoke with Professor Friedman by phone in April of 2002, and asked her to talk about why feminism did not evolve as people evolved and civilization developed.
Well, the historical argument that I make is that feminism is born of a very particular historical moment, so that we can't talk about feminism in ancient history or medieval history, that feminism is a politics that comes out of the Enlightenment and the call for the rights of man, a period of questioning of hierarchies of all kinds, and talking about self-determination for people.
Can you give us some examples?
Well, Mary Wollstonecraft, writing at the end of the 1700s, very much a supporter of the French Revolution and a radical political thinker, becomes one of the first feminist writers, really calling not just for education but for opportunities for women, and questioning the relegation of women in the Western tradition to only the home and motherhood. Another example would be the anti-slavery movement in the U.S. in the 1830s and 1840s, another moment when these ideas of what we sometimes call modern democratic societies or the era of democratic revolutions, abolitionists want to extend the rights of man to black men as well as white men. And some of the women involved, like Sarah Angelina Grimke or Sojourner Truth, a former slave, or Frederick Douglass, another former slave, all of them called for extending those rights to all women and all men. So you can see that connection between an idea of equal rights and extending it to its logical conclusion, really. I would say that in earlier eras, going back hundreds and hundreds of years, most societies accepted a hierarchy. It was patriarchy, it was the rule of elites or of aristocrats or monarchs, and here's this moment historically when that changes and we call for self-representation, and that's when you get the birth of feminism.
Well, what occurred from your perspective during the Seneca Falls meetings and the suffragist organization in the 1870s through the 1890s that did not result in women having the right to vote at that time.
Why suffrage took so long? Essentially, is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Well, it's a huge change to go from a worldview in which women are dependent on men in the family, that the bargain is that men are going to take care of women and women are going to be dependent on men, and that men represent women politically. They vote for the whole family. It's a big change to have women have independent identities as citizens. And I argue in No Turning Back that the momentum for that change gradually builds, not just because of those political ideals we were talking about, but also because of changes in the economy. And the more that women enter wage earning, the more that women enter professions, higher education, teaching, and particularly in the 20th century, as our economy needs more women workers, the clerks and the department stores, and later the communications revolution, that there's a greater momentum for extending those political ideals. So it's really two pieces here historically. One is the political ideal, self-representation, but the other is the economic change of industrialization and wage labor and market economies, and really the shift from the old family self-sufficient farm to the urban commercial economy, where women increasingly are involved in that public world of labor and as consumers. So what I'm saying is that eventually women are in the public world. They become full citizens gradually, and that's when you begin to get public opinion empowering women politically as well.
Well, what about the sexual freedom that was advanced by the birth control pill in the early 1960s that allowed women to stay in the public world? What power do you give to that?
I give it some power, but historically I want to go way back, because women were controlling fertility in the United States long before the 1960s. I'll give you some statistics. In 1800, the average married woman bore around 8 children. In 1900, the average married woman bore around 4 children. By 2000, around 2 children. That did not wait for the birth control pill. That change in fertility control comes with farm to city, agriculture to industry and commercial. Children are no longer an economic asset. We don't need them as farm laborers. They're not going to take care of their elderly parents. Society is changing, and families decide to have fewer children. They use diaphragms, they use condoms, they use abstinence, they use abortion, which wasn't criminalized, you know, till the 1870s and later, and they continue to use it when it's illegal. What I think the birth control pill does is open up publicly this conversation, not just about marital fertility control, but premarital use of contraception. And also, it coincides with a new sexual value system that's emerging in the post-war period. And so I don't think that it's the pill per se that makes these changes, but it's rather part of a much longer use of contraception in marriage and then later outside of marriage.
Going back a little bit to the control of women and the hierarchies which control women, what role would you put on religion in doing that?
Historically, religion has had a dual effect on women. On the one hand, many Western religions have relegated women to secondary roles. Women are not prophets, women do not speak to God, they have to be led by male clergy. On the other hand, religion has often given space for women to have authority. I'm thinking of Buddhist nuns, Catholic nuns, who in the Middle Ages, for example, in Europe, Catholic nuns had huge monasteries or nunneries where the women in the convents ran the place and were learned and created. So there could be a space outside of marriage for women, whether it was Buddhist women in China who were not marrying in a fairly patriarchal system, or the nuns in Europe who were able to have education and be creative and not marry. So religion also has given women spiritual authority when they are married and have children, as either teachers of children or in the Jewish tradition, domestic religion, the importance of certain domestic rituals for the religion. So it's a double-edged sword. And what's happened, I think, with feminism since the 1800s and in the last century, women asking to be able to be spiritually empowered not only in the private sphere of the home or by giving up marriage, but to be spiritually empowered in the same ways that men can be, that is, as followers or leaders in the home or in the church or synagogue. And there's been enormous change on that front, certainly in the West, as women enter the ministry and the rabbinate and have taken much more active roles as leaders in religions and not only as followers.
Estelle, let's bring this into the current time. How do you analyze feminism now in the 21st century?
For me, one of the most exciting things I found in working on No Turning Back was the way that the historical changes that we describe in the West in the 1800s and 1900s are moving into many other parts of the world.
For example?
Well, we can find women organizing women on every continent on the earth right now. We have the UN conferences in the 1970s, the 80s, and 90s, whether you're looking at Mexico City from 1975 to Beijing in 1995, brought thousands and thousands of organizers together to learn about women's movements in Africa, in South Asia, everywhere, in Latin America. And they range from mothers organizing in Latin America to find their disappeared children, to mothers in East Los Angeles who are calling for a moratorium on prison construction because their sons are going to go to prison, from that maternalist politics all the way to the reproductive rights activists and the West and in other parts of the world, to the women in Africa who are doing grassroots village health care and changing attitudes about female genital cutting in the process of that health education.
Well, how about for teenage girls in America?
In America, teenage girls, I think, have a really hard time. And as much as people talk about the progress we've made for women in this country, I see late adolescents in college, and I certainly know from younger women, that the concerns about the body, sexual vulnerability, the extent of abuse of both girls and boys in childhood, the extent of eating disorders, all suggest that young women in our culture are very conflicted about whether they are judged by appearance or by their minds and souls. And I think that we still have a long way to go in treating adolescent girls in a way that will empower them to become women who are strong and confident. One way that we've made a lot of progress is athletics. You know, the feminist movement helped to change the law so that schools have got to give money to girls' sports as well as boys' sports. And that has created a generation now of even professional athletes, collegiate professional athletes, who've come through those programs. And that's one way of empowering girls physically and mentally. But I think we have more work to do on that. Still, teachers call on boys more than girls, and I think that many young girls don't see the opportunity, specifically young girls of color, some immigrant young girls need a lot of mentoring and need to know that really the sky's the limit, that they can do and should be allowed to do whatever they want with their lives.
You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of national interest.
This week we're talking with Professor Estelle B. Friedman about her new book, No Turning Back, The History of Feminism and the Future of Women. I'm Barry Vogel. Estelle, how can these images or role models be presented where they have been absent in the past?
One of the places we are finding them is in culture, in literature. I think there's been an explosion of wonderful literary representations, whether it's the novels of Toni Morrison or the poetry of Maya Angelou and the work of writers in Native American women writers, of Mexican American women writers. I think of the work of Shri Moraga, who have really been inspirational to this generation coming of age to take themselves seriously as creative artists and also as strong, free women who can make their own choices. So I think some of that is happening in culture. We can see it in theater, in novels, in poetry. What it hasn't penetrated as much is popular culture, outside of those who are looking for the feminist message, although I think that some of this feminist literature has made the mainstream. There's still a lot of mainstream images in Hollywood and in advertising that tend to limit the representations of women and create this ideal of, you know, the thin white woman with a beautiful body, and that is what we should all aspire to. And I think that's damaging to girls and women, and quite honestly I think it's damaging to men too, because most of them really cannot aspire to possessing this woman.
It's interesting that you use the word possess.
Yes.
What do you mean?
Well, I think that those media images create fantasies that beautiful, thin, white woman is something that if you buy the product she's advertising, you will then, in a sense, be buying access to her. It's a fantasy. It's not true, and that's why I think it's damaging not just for the women, but also for the men who are, in a sense, being encouraged to spend their money on the things these women are advertising.
But it's certainly an effective marketing tool.
Yes, I think you're right. It can be very effective. But I think that if we could bring alternative images into the market, that it would in some way help to undermine that power. And going back to the question of athletics, have you noticed that we do have some alternative images now of strong female athletes, as well as of working and professional women and of women scientists? The more we have those kind of images in the media and in advertising, I think the healthier we will all be, and we'll be a little more attuned to our reality.
Generally, social and political movements come from the people who are oppressed by the status quo. How do you see those kinds of images being brought into the forefront? Is it the commercialism that's involved, or would it be the oppressed women moving forward?
Well, those who study social movements argue that sometimes it's not the most oppressed who organize, because they don't have the resources. If you're just barely being able to survive, it's harder to go out and organize. Sometimes it's those who have, you know, that revolution of rising expectations, women who get a little bit of education, then begin to mobilize in trying to seek greater rights. And I think that if you look around the world right now, there are many women in countries like India and in certain countries in Africa and Latin America, where women who have had some opportunities, let's say access to education, access to the media, are trying to mobilize to help those who are really the most impoverished. 70% of those living in poverty in the world today are female. And women represent 2/3 of those who are illiterate in the world. Now, when you're illiterate and living in poverty, it's hard to go out and petition your legislature. And so we have many projects around the world to try to bring literacy to women, to try to bring economic enterprise, projects like microlending, which started in South Asia and has spread around the world. And I think that when I talk about those conferences in Beijing, for example, of women coming together to share what do we need to do in different cultures, sometimes those women are coming from the most, quote, oppressed, but sometimes they're those who are trying to enable change for the women who can't get to a conference or who are not exposed to some of these world movements and media. And, you know, I argue in No Turning Back that these kinds of changes have implications for our whole world, for men and women, because if you can bring literacy to those women, if you can bring some of the women living in poverty out of poverty through becoming small entrepreneurs, for example, everybody's standard of living in the family will increase, and you begin to cut some of that gap between the rich and the poor. You begin to bring whole families out of poverty. So addressing the empowerment of women around the world, I think, really is going to help all of us. And it's also going to help women who are in the most oppressed situation. For example, if you have a woman who is completely economically dependent on a man in a poor family, and if there is hostility in the family, if there's domestic abuse, if he is taking out his poverty, let's say, on women and children in the family, she's not able to leave that abuse unless she has a resource, domestic violence shelter, an economic empowerment program, a literacy training program is going to give her leverage in the household either to end that abuse or to leave it and to be able to start over.
Estelle, in your book, No Turning Back, you talk about the feminists' debate of pornography and sex work. Can you tell us about that?
Well, there's been a long-standing conflict about strategies in terms of what do we do with offensive images of women, pornographic images of women. And on the one hand, some feminists emphasize the danger of those images and their exploitation of women. And when women go into sex work as prostitutes or working in the pornography industry, that they're exploited. Other feminists who are against censorship and feel we need more free speech and that women have been denied the opportunity to speak about sex think we need to give every woman a choice. Does she want to engage in sex work, prostitution, pornography? Should women be producing their own feminist pornography? And sometimes there's been angry debate between those who emphasize the dangers of sex and those who emphasize the pleasures of sex. My argument is that if you take the long view, there is a common ground under both of those, and I think both sides are arguing for sexual self-determination. That is, to extend that right to self-determination to sexuality. One group wants women not to be forced into sex work or pornography, and only if women have other economic choices will they not feel forced into it. Remember, we still have a wage gap, and it's a particularly big wage gap for immigrant women and women of color, so that is there a choice in terms of how they can support themselves? The other side wants sexual self-determination of women being able to explore sexual pleasure, whatever that means. So I do think there's a common ground there of women determining their own sexuality and their choices, but some people emphasize one part of it and some the other. I mean, I could probably...
Estelle, let's talk about the conflict that many women feel about being a mother, having a family, and being a wage earner or being a professional.
Yes, that's a good question, because women have increasingly been working for wages in our country and around the world. Most mothers now are also wage earners. Indeed, most mothers of small children are also wage earners. And what feminism is trying to come to terms with today is how can we accommodate the wage-earning mother through adequate child care, through tax credits for child care, but also through bringing men into the family and into the kind of caregiving work that women have been doing for so long. In the initial stages of feminism, I think in our own century or in our own lifetime, in the 20th century, we emphasized getting women into the wage labor force, and now we're talking more about how to bring men into the caregiving force. If you look at Scandinavia, there's some wonderful policies that are giving extra time off with pay for fathers who stay home with their young children, and increasingly men are taking advantage of that opportunity. So social policy can help with that, as can the way we raise boys and girls so that they're not separated into those who will be parents and those who will not have the opportunity to be parents. That's one way we can look at the issues of work and family. Feminists are really seeking social policy to break down that caregiver-breadwinner divide and allow both men and women to engage in both kinds of activities.
Let's talk about politics. California is unique in that both senators are women. What do you see as the change of women being involved in policy-making positions in government, politics, and business?
It's been an enormous change. There have been more and more women going into elected office, not only in the United States, but in Latin America and Western Europe. The percentage of women in the legislatures has doubled in the last generation. Now, it's still small, more like 13% in this country and up to 25 or more percent in parts of Europe and Scandinavia, almost up to half. But it's the increase that gives me the sense of momentum, the sense of no turning back. Not only are women going into politics, but they're going into politics more explicitly as women representing women's interests than they once did when they were the few token women who had to be more warlike than men, if you know what I mean. We have organizations like Emily's List here or Win-Win in Japan in which women raise money for women candidates. And we have some very interesting new electoral mechanisms to try to achieve political equity. In France last year, a program called Parité was put into effect in which political parties, in order to get their full funding from the state, have to nominate equal numbers of men and women on the ballot. And this went into the municipal elections last year, so you now have 50% women in many municipal positions. In India, there's a somewhat related mechanism in which low caste and female candidates are given slots on the ballot, and as a result, there are now thousands of low-caste women in India who have become members of municipal councils, and they have put that position to work to get better water, better sewage, the issues that really affect women and girls who otherwise would spend most of their life hauling water. That means girls can go to school, learn to read, and become literate. So I see electoral change feeding back into the kind of social changes we were talking about to empower women around the world.
Estelle, the subtitle of your book concludes with the future of women. What do you see as the future of women?
I see a world in which women have full human rights, that those democratic ideals of the past few centuries and those market economies that are spreading throughout the world are going to create the conditions for feminists, for women's movements, for male allies to really demand that women have full human rights economically, politically, sexually. It's not going to come inevitably, only with vigilance, only with effecting new social policies, only with monitoring human rights and making women's lives part of the human rights agenda will that happen. But I do believe the momentum is there and there will be no turning back from this effort to make women full citizens in every way.
Professor Estelle Friedman, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you to tell us about an interesting book, or perhaps two, that you've read lately.
Well, the first things that come to my mind, the first thing is fiction. I recently had the chance to read Margaret Atwood's wonderful novel, The Blind Assassin, and I felt that, in addition to being a brilliantly constructed novel, at the core are some of those feminist concerns about the impact of public events on the private lives of women and the way that women see the world differently from their experiences in the home. It reminded me of reading Virginia Woolf in many ways and breaking down that public-private divide that feminism has questioned in our last century. And the other book I read recently and indeed went to see as a play is Eve Ensler's The Vagina Monologues, which is a great example of feminist theater trying to change the world.
Professor Estelle B. Friedman, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That's it for Sprouts. You have been listening to Dr. Estelle B. Friedman of San Francisco, California, History of Feminism. This program brought to you by Radio Curious and Barry Vogel in Ukiah, California, with assistance from Pacifica Radio. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Brian David at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase nationally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hello, KBOO members. Thank you for being part of our amazing community. It takes all of us to manage this great community resource, and the role played by the KBOO Board of Directors is essential. Here's an opportunity for you to join the KBOO Board and become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all of our members. Please consider applying to become a KBOO Board member if you want to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to good use. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm and fill out an application, or stop by the station to pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is July 13, 2019. We are looking for folks who love KBOO, who are committed to our community, and who want to carry forward KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change. KBOO needs you. Apply today.
And this is KBOO Portland, and it is 10, it's getting up on 10:01 a.m. We're going to hear Madness Radio bringing you voices and visions from outside mental health. And at 10:30, film at 11, Mona and DK discuss Midsommar. I'm guessing on the pronunciation there. The new film from Hereditary director Ari Aster, and other releases, revivals, and television programs. At 11, Pacific Underground features an interview with City of Portland Communications Manager